Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of InForum, dubbed the Hip Young Division of the Commonwealth Club, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum. I'm Josh Richmond, politics and legal affairs writer for the Oakland Tribune and Bay Area News Group. Joining me tonight are Tim Rosales, campaign manager for No on Prop 19, Dr. Bo Kilmer, co-director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center, and Richard Lee, co-proponent of Proposition 19 and founder of Oaksterdam University. Now it's our chance to dig into the issues. Let's get started. I wanted to start talking a little bit about the economics of Prop 19 and about the revenue that it may or may not bring to the state, the cities, and the counties that are all struggling with such horrible budget deficits these days. How much is this likely to help, given the fact that the proposition itself, as you probably know, doesn't set forth a statewide scheme for taxation and regulation? It allows cities and counties to choose whether to regulate and regulate and tax commercial cultivation and sales. So, Mr. Lee, why don't you start us off talking a little bit about the possible revenues?
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for being here to hear about Prop 19. First of all, the state is already collecting somewhere around $105 million a year in sales tax on medical marijuana, and there's been no initiative or legislation to authorize that. The Board of Equalization just did it on its own. Our initiative foresees that will kick in immediately with adult cannabis, that we will have around the 10% sales tax statewide. So there is a state sales tax that will come in immediately, plus the local excise taxes. About 10 cities have local referendums setting up local taxes.
Including several here in the Bay Area, correct?
Exactly. Oakland, Richmond, Berkeley, San Jose, Sacramento. And then I forget what else you had in your question there about the tax benefits. We also have the indirect benefits. We talk a lot about the excise taxes, like the Board of Equalization estimates $1.5 billion from a $50 an ounce excise tax. But we don't talk much about the ancillary benefits, the jobs created, the taxes paid from those, and all the other, indirect benefits that would come from, the businesses that supply the cannabis business and so forth. Also, there's the hemp industry. We don't talk much about that, but the California farmers in the valley could actually bring in more industry and more money than the drug type of cannabis from hemp products. Whole Foods sells lots of hemp soy milk and hemp seed nutrition bars, all grown by Canadian farmers, because right now it's illegal for American farmers to grow hemp. Prop 19 would make California the 8th state to legalize hemp.
So, Mr. Rosales, your campaign's been saying that a lot of these possible revenues are just that, only possibilities, and outweighed by some of the potential costs.
Yeah, I think Mr. Lee has some good points. But I think that, looking at the potential revenues, they're all speculative. The Board of Equalization has weighed in their most recent report saying it's highly speculative. The San Francisco Chronicle has said that that Proposition 19 will not cure our budget deficit. You have opposition from California League of Cities and California State Association of Counties. I think the assumptions being made by proponents of Prop 19 are that each city and county would actually authorize sales, cultivation, et cetera, on a widespread level. And that is not the experience we've seen both from Proposition 215, and we're not seeing that, really cities embracing the possibility of Prop 19 passing. In fact, many cities have come out with resolutions opposing Proposition 19, and much of that is due to at least what they've talked about, potential additional regulatory costs that they have that they don't currently have money for, and they don't foresee large tax revenue coming from that, especially with the part of the initiative that allows individual growth on a 5x5 foot plot. So I think cities are going into it with kind of a looking at it very suspiciously.
Dr. Kilmer, you want a piece of this, or should we move on to your research?
I'll take a small piece.
All right.
We looked into this in a study that was released in July, and as Richard mentioned, there's this estimate out there that if marijuana were to be legalized in California, it would bring in $1.4 billion a year. But that was not based on an analysis of Prop 19. That was based on an analysis of Amiano's bill from two sessions ago. It's important to realize that that assumes that there would be this $50 an ounce tax. It also assumes that there would be no tax evasion. And also, it's important to realize that it assumes that the current level of consumption would be at the same quality. We estimated that after legalization, the price is going to go down, and Californians are going to be more likely to be using the good stuff, higher quality, more THC. But with that, whereas, you know, whereas before somebody may have bought, you know, three grams for a weekend because they were going out of the Mexican stuff, now they may only have to buy 1 gram. And if you adjust for the quality, you realize that the amount of revenue would actually be lower because the tax is not based on THC. The tax would be based on total weight. And so for a number of reasons, we thought that the actual amount of money could actually be lower, but it actually could be higher. Because if the high-quality marijuana coming out of California, if people pay taxes on it and smuggle it to other states, and a lot of money could actually be generated. I mean, no, for real. I mean, you realize that about 6/7 of all the marijuana consumed in the United States is actually consumed outside of California. Now, of course, that's going to depend not only on the federal response, but also on the responses of the other states, as well as the rate of taxation and the amount of regulation imposed. So our take on this was, depending on what scenario and what you believe, it could be lower than $1.4 billion, or it could be higher.
Since you talked about the issue of legal California marijuana going over the borders into other states where it's not legal, that also came up in another study that you guys did dealing with whether or not Prop 19's passage would have an appreciable impact on the Mexican drug cartels.
Yeah, that was motivated by, there's this figure that's been floating around for 5 years that came out during the Bush administration that claimed that of all of the drug trafficking export revenues that these Mexican cartels make, that 60% of it comes from marijuana. That number's been floating around for 5 years, and in the study that we've just released, we actually looked back to where the number came from, and we found that, the takeaway is that no one should take that number seriously. Hmm. First of all, it was literally in a report, nobody knows how it was generated. Subsequent estimates from the Department of Justice show there was a wide variety, a wide range of estimates already out there. Third, if you actually believe these estimates, they imply a consumption level that's 3 times higher than the upper bound estimate you would get from the United Nations. And so, it just has no face validity. And then also, 4 weeks ago, the Office of National Drug Control Policy actually publicly distanced itself from this figure. Realize this was a figure that was created by the Office of National Drug Control Policy, but during the Bush administration. And then finally, we came up with our own estimates, and we thought that the actual figure is probably closer to 20%. But getting back to your question, our takeaway on this was if Prop 19 only influences what happens in California, we don't think it's going to have much of an impact on the export revenues for these drug trafficking organizations. I mean, they have portfolios. They export cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, and realize that California only accounts for a small portion of total consumption in the United States, and we have a lot of domestic production here. So if it only influences Mexico, or I'm sorry, if it only influences California, we thought it may only reduce the total export revenues by 2-4%. That's not a lot. However, there is a scenario if the high quality stuff is exported out at prices that outcompete the stuff that comes from Mexico, and it gets to the point where the Mexican drug trafficking organizations say, you know what, we're not going to be pushing marijuana into the United States anymore, then they could lose between 13-23% of their total export revenues, significantly higher.
So, Richard, given what Bo was just saying, I know that one of the selling points of Prop 19 has been it would undercut the Mexican cartels, would undercut some of the gang crime that goes on here in California. What of this?
Well, first of all, to address the point of California doesn't, if we pass Prop 19, it still doesn't do anything for the other 49 states. Mm-hmm. But we do have to start somewhere. If we look at the history of repealing alcohol prohibition, New York and California repealed it before we repealed federal prohibition in the 20s. Actually, we legalized it here first, mm-hmm. then it spread to other states, and finally the 21st Amendment legalized it federally, but only in states that chose to legalize it right away. And in fact, Kansas didn't legalize alcohol till 1946, Mississippi till 1966, 33 years after federal prohibition ended. So this is going to be state by state. We do have to start somewhere, to end the violence down in Mexico, whether it's 20% or 60%, And it's hard to, I think you guys agree that your numbers, you're not for sure exactly whether it's 20% or 50 or 60%.
It was 13 to 23.
But, I mean, your numbers are based on speculation, too, because this is an underground black market, you know, so you, it's hard for you
to really.
So it could be 50 or 60 or 70%. You know, and my point is.
Since you have the books of the cartels, obviously for you to audit and to tell.
No, you're exactly right that there's uncertainty here, and the one thing that we've been very honest about in both of our reports is, hey, look, there is uncertainty here. You need to be thinking about these figures in terms of ranges, not point estimates. And so actually when we do these numbers, we actually account for that in the simulations. We account for the fact that we don't know how much marijuana is consumed in the United States. Our best estimate is probably 3,300 metric tons, but we consider a range between 1,500 and 5,000 metric tons. When we were trying to come up with our ranges for the amount of marijuana, if you look at all the marijuana that's consumed in the United States, how much comes from Mexico, that's really hard to figure out. But we were able to use price data to kind of come up with what we think is an extreme range. We think at the extreme lower bound, it would be 40%. At the extreme higher bound, it would be 67%. You know, one of the things that we do in this report is we build that into these simulations, but more importantly, because, I mean, we do spend a lot of our reports criticizing other numbers, we're very transparent. We put it all out there. Here's the uncertainty. When we get better numbers, let's plug them into these models. But, I mean, we're very open about that, and you're right, there is a lot of uncertainty. But with respect to the amount of money they get from exporting marijuana to the United States, it really is going to be about 20%.
I'll get to you in 1 second. I just wanted to have Richard sort of finish up talking about not so much even the cartels, but the California gang violence that has been associated with the drug trade, and whether you think that legalization would have some meaningful effect on that.
Sure. I mean, if we look at the history of alcohol prohibition, you know, that a lot of the violence there was for, you know, small sales and protection of turf of retail sales. And, you know, we don't see Budweiser and Miller and Jack Daniels and Jim Beam shooting it out, you know, and I think the same thing will be true with when we civilize the cannabis retail market.
Now, Tim, I think you see some problems with California going first in this.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, looking back at alcohol prohibition, it didn't mean that the mafia went away. They just looked for something else to do, some other illegal but, you know, high-risk, high-reward type of industry, and they're currently, you know, continuing and doing that today. So I think that is problematic. I also think that, and, you know, on opposing Proposition 19 is, you know, every major law enforcement entity in California. And one of the things that they talk about is that there still is, marijuana would still be illegal for people 21 years and under. And so, you know, as you still have a black market or, minors obtaining tobacco, alcohol, all those types of things illegally, there's still going to be that demand on for marijuana and how they get it. And so I think that to say that a black market would completely disappear because of Prop 19 isn't necessarily accurate.
If I can just respond to that, are you saying that we need to legalize alcohol for everybody under 21 as well to totally get rid of the black market for alcohol?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
My point is, if it works for alcohol, it can work for cannabis.
Well, one thing that I think, and pardon me if I misquote you, correct me if I do, Bo, but the RAND studies have shown is that consumption is going to go up, is that, you know, we're pretty certain that will happen if Prop 19 passes. And so I think that you have to look at that, you know, the overall social impact of that, especially towards people, again, who are under 21. And one of the things that your initiative does is, you know, as far as penalties for people who are under 21 right now, where if a high school senior who's 18 years old passes a joint to their girlfriend who's 17 years old, it's, it's an infraction. Under Proposition 19, you would actually charge that person with a felony and subject them to, you know, potentially 6 months in prison, plus thousands of dollars in fines, which is currently what's written in Proposition 19, which isn't the law right now. So, I mean, I think that, but getting back to the black market, I think that, you know, again, kids are still going to access in greater degree than they do now.
Just to respond to the one thing about that, consumption will go up as a given. I'm not sure what you based your numbers on that, but if we compare states that have lower penalties to states that have higher penalties, we don't see higher consumption. If we look at the Netherlands, where coffee shops have been openly selling it for 35 years, they actually have about half the consumption that we do. especially with kids. There's some theories that by getting rid of the forbidden fruit attraction, you can actually reduce the attraction to kids. So if you, look at, and then the other thing is the availability to kids. If you track, our last 40 years of prohibition, kids have said easy to get cannabis, 80% kids have said, but about 40% of them do try it. Why aren't the other 40% if it's, 80% easy to get? In other words, they're already maxed out. Everybody who wants it can already get it. The idea that it's going to make it any easier when 80% of the kids already have said during prohibition they can get it. And the other 20%, if they can get it, I don't think you'd be able to force them to do it.
I didn't say that it was going to get easier necessarily. I said that it's still going to be there, that there's still going to be this, they're going to try to get it in other non-legal ways.
Bo, you want to talk about your numbers on consumption?
No. Richard, the first point you made about if you're looking at decriminalized states, you're exactly right. Like, there isn't much of a difference there. That's for decriminalization. That's not for legalization. For the Netherlands, a lot of people like to think that they legalized marijuana in the Netherlands. They didn't do that at all. They tolerate consumption and purchases of small amounts. So if you're over 18, you can walk into one of these coffee shops and you can buy up to 5 grams. But they tolerate that. It's not legal. But production and production and distribution is still illegal there. That's why the prices are still high. It has not been legalized. And so when we did our estimates, our takeaway is that if you legalize marijuana in California, use is going to go up. But we don't know how much. We're very clear about that we don't know how much. And you can think about this in kind of two different areas. You have the non-price effects, and then you have the price effects. So kind of on the non-price side, for some folks, it's going to change, for some people it may change the stigma. It could change perceived harmfulness. But then you also have to think about the potential for advertising and consumption. And advertising and promotion. And for those reasons, we think that could be a reason why use would increase. But you also have to think about what's going to happen with prices. We know that users and potential users of marijuana are sensitive to the price of marijuana, just as they are for alcohol, just as they are for tobacco. And so we know that if there's going to be a large decrease in price, that we would expect there to be an increase in consumption. However, and most people around agree that, whether it be us or normal, agree that there's going to be a large price drop. We can quibble about whether it's 60, 70, 80%, but it's going to be large. But the problem is it's really hard to figure out, given that we have this large price drop, how much use is going to increase. Because usually when you do these types of analyses, it's focusing on kind of small changes, right, on the margins. So, if a price of a joint increases a couple dollars, how much is that going to increase consumption? Things that are fairly small. However, the price drop that you would expect to see after legalization in California, it would be a fairly large drop. So large that it actually requires that you know what the shape of the demand curve looks like. But in order to really understand, and we don't know this. We don't know what the demand curve looks like. We don't know what the supply curve looks like. We don't know what the tax rate's going to be with Proposition 19. We don't know what the level of advertising and promotion are going to be. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. But definitely we think, but from what we know about the economics of this and what we know about how people would respond to advertising and possible promotion, use is going to increase. But we don't know how much. But to kind of put this in perspective, in any given month in California, about 6.5% of the population uses marijuana, about 2 million folks. Say we were to double that. Say we were to increase the past month prevalence rate from 6.5 to 13%, we'd be back to where we were in the late 1970s. Now, granted, the marijuana today is a little bit stronger and society is different. We have less disco. But, we actually have lived in a society before where the past month prevalence rate was twice as high.
Okay, just one thing,
please.
That we might see people switching from alcohol to cannabis, and that might actually be a benefit to society, healthier, and we might have less alcoholism and less problems with that.
You're exactly right, and we tried looking at that in our study, trying to figure out whether or not alcohol and marijuana are substitutes or complements. And actually, the literature on that is not, the literature on that is not very good. And so we end up coming out not taking a stand about whether or not we expect that alcohol consumption will increase or decrease. But our takeaway, though, is that that's actually going to matter quite a bit because we know that the social costs associated with alcohol use are really high. So, and I think a lot of it's going to depend on how it's implemented in different places. And you could expect that it may have different effects on alcohol use for different populations. So, if Prop 19 passes or another type of, legalization passes somewhere else, this is something that we really need to look into. So I think alcohol is a big issue here.
You got thoughts on this alcohol versus tobacco substitution here?
No.
Not really.
No.
You mean cannabis.
I'm sorry, yes. Yes, my bad. Then I want to get back to something that you referenced when you were speaking a moment ago about law enforcement opposition to this. It's not uniform opposition. There definitely are some people, current and former law enforcement people, who have endorsed Proposition 19, who believe that this is the first step in ending a war on drugs that's been more harm than help. But on the whole, most large law enforcement organizations have opposed this. Prop 19, one of the selling points has been that it would reduce the law enforcement costs associated with these arrests and prosecutions. Governor Schwarzenegger recently signed into law a bill that reduces simple possession of less than an ounce from a misdemeanor punishable only by a $100 fine to an infraction only punishable by a $100 fine. The difference being there is no criminal record attached to that, and that there is no entitlement to jury trial and a court-appointed attorney, thus reducing some of the costs. Do you think, Tim, that Governor Schwarzenegger took some of the wind out of the sails of that law enforcement cost reduction argument by doing that?
Well, I think, you know, already you had where I think the 2008-2009 numbers from California Department of Correction showed less than 1% of people in California state prisons were there, you know, solely because of marijuana possession, and most of those people were large-scale drug dealers intent to possess or intent to distribute.
It doesn't necessarily include parole violators who get sent back up on a marijuana
charge. Doesn't necessarily consider that, but again, less than 1%. I think that, you know, again, I'm not a police officer. I'm not on the street. But what they tell us is that they don't spend a lot of time on minor marijuana possession. In fact, they don't want to. It's not anything that they want to deal with, and so it's not a big ticket cost or expense for them right now. They're already focused on larger scale crimes. They're already strapped with what they can do out on the streets, and so I think that the reduction from the governor. From a misdemeanor to a simple infraction, and still in practice it has been a $100 ticket, which is less than you would get if you were speeding over the Bay Bridge. So I think that it removes another reason. You know, you've got the speculative tax question, you've got some other questions. I think this just removes another reason to vote in favor of Proposition 19, but a reason to vote now.
Richard, I think you probably have some thoughts on the law enforcement costs and why an infraction is still not a good deal.
Well, it is still on your record. It still can be looked up as far as employers using it against you and things like that. But also, it is 60,000 citations or arrests before it was changed now that California has a year. So we are wasting law enforcement resources. And, that would be better used going after the real predators and sociopaths out there. Mm-hmm. And I think also it's a matter of returning respect for the laws and law enforcement, because when people feel like, they're being harassed for something that's no different than what's advertised on television, the Budweiser and Miller that's advertised during the World Series going on right now, you think that the laws aren't fair or just, you can't separate between, the police should be protecting us from other people, not trying to protect us from ourselves in this case.
Bo, what did you find about law enforcement costs and potential savings?
Well, before we did the study, there were two other estimates out there looking at how much California spent arresting and adjudicating marijuana offenders. There was one study out there by California Normal, Dale Geringer did it, and he put the cost at about $200 million a year. There was another study that was out there that put the cost closer to $2 billion a year. I mean, that's an order of magnitude difference. And so for this particular piece, it actually really isn't rocket science. Give me the number of arrestees, what happens in adjudication, information about who's incarcerated. I mean, yeah, there are about, I think last year there were over 75,000 arrests for marijuana sales or marijuana possession in California. But on any given day in California, you only have about 1,500 to 1,600 people that are actually incarcerated. So you kind of figure that all out, and our best estimate was that the total amount spent was less than $300 million. So if you're thinking about this, I mean, there are costs. Be thinking hundreds of millions, not billions.
Now, Prop 19 supporters have released some interesting studies just in the past week about who's being arrested Well, why don't you tell us a little bit, about that, Richard?
There's been several studies and just a couple of new ones released this year, but other ones going back quite a few years to confirm the same thing, that minorities are arrested 4 times or even greater the rate than other members of the population, and even though we all consume cannabis at the same amount. And it makes sense when you think about how the law enforcement is targeted after street dealers, people like that, you know, where other people, you know, can work out of, like, suburban homes and things like that, whereas, you know, other people get caught up in the crime enforcement of urban street dealing.
Tim?
Well, you know, I think, again, Richard has a point, and certainly arrest disparities is something that needs to be addressed. But is that going to be solved by Proposition 19, or is that a greater public policy issue? And what we would argue, and again, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives who are opposing Proposition 19 say, it is a problem, but that doesn't have anything to do with Proposition 19, or Proposition 19 does not solve that problem. So I think that law enforcement, and I can't speak for them particularly, but I think they would agree, or at least you've got some groups out there that agree that arrest disparities are a real issue. But then, again, getting back to Proposition 19, like we've talked about, is that really the public policy solution for that? And I would argue that no, it isn't. It doesn't necessarily get to the root of that problem.
Now, Richard, there have been some interesting divisions in the African American community over Prop 19. The NAACP endorsed relatively early, but a lot of the African American religious community took a hard stance against this. What are you seeing and hearing as you conduct this campaign?
Well, I don't think Bishop, as he calls himself, Ron Allen, is really representative of a large part. If you look at, you know, his background and stuff, he doesn't have a large organization or anything, and the media has given him a lot more credibility, I think, than, you know, if you researched him, he deserves. So I think we, you know, it's been a battle to get minorities to support ending cannabis prohibition. It's been a issue that we've had in the reform community for years that we have not had much support. And so the fact that we do have the NAACP this year endorsing, it's the first time a civil rights organization has come out in favor of ending cannabis prohibition is a first step, and one more sign that we are we're getting more support every year.
Tammy, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that you certainly do have division within the communities of color. I think every most recent surveys have shown some deep opposition within the Latino community, within the African American community, to Proposition 19. I think that they, because of again, we talk about things like arrest disparities and different issues that affect those communities, have a very keen sense of what this type of thing, what this means, what Proposition 19 would mean to their community. And I think they're looking for something a little bit that offers them some more protection on this. But but certainly it is an issue of question. But I think that, as I said, most recent surveys have shown some pretty strong opposition within both of those communities.
Let's talk a little bit about federal enforcement. The Attorney General sort of fired a shot across your bow, I think, Richard, this month by publicizing a letter that he was sending to the former DEA chiefs, basically saying that no matter what California does on November 2nd, federal law enforcement stance is going to remain the same. They won't tolerate massive cultivation and sale of marijuana, which sort of puts a bug in the ear, I guess, of some cities that are considering doing this. Oakland has actually moved to authorize some larger grows for medical purposes and perhaps down the line other uses as well. What are there risks associated with being the first city to jump on this bandwagon?
Sure. I mean, if we look at the history of Prop 215, the federal government did the same thing. We had all the ex-presidents come out against Prop 215 and all the major politicians in California were against 215, and 56% of California voters voted for it, and now we have 14 other states that have followed, and the science continues to show that the voters of Californians were right and the politicians were wrong and the federal government was wrong. And so I think, you know, we're seeing history repeat itself with this. And, you know, it's amazing if you look at the history of Oakland began taxing and regulating cannabis outlets, dispensaries in 2004, Bush administration, you know, now actively opposing, you know, medical marijuana and busting places, but still Oakland did it and other cities followed. And I think, you know, we're going to see a similar.
Is this a form of leadership that basically entails throwing yourself on the grenade, though? You know, I mean, in terms of.
Well, if you look at the history of civil rights movements, you know, there a lot of sacrifices have been made, you know, whether it's, you know, women's rights or, you know, any number of civil rights issues. They, you know, that it hasn't happened, you know, peacefully or, you know what I mean, without sacrifice. People have had to engage in civil disobedience and push the envelope. And as far as the other thing with being California is showing the Democrats how much this can help them. They that were, you know, potentially going to help the Democrats get elected in California by bringing out young voters who are showing up to vote just for Prop 19. So there's already been Democratic consultants looking into what other states they could put cannabis on the ballot in 2012 to help re-elect Obama and other Democrats. And so that might be one reason that the federal government will not be as opposed to it. I could see how the federal government or Obama administration might want 19 to lose so it'll get back on the ballot in 2012 to help them.
That seems that pretty race. Machiavellian. You really, you think that's part of the calculus, really?
Like I said, there was a Wall Street Journal piece that talked about how Democratic consultants are already polling and looking into how this can be the issue, just like gay marriage was for Republicans in 2004.
I do want to do the politicization of this in a second, but first, and before I get to your rebuttal on that, could you reiterate some of the stuff that you found both in the economics and dealing with the cartels in terms of what federal law enforcement how that could factor into the efficacy of Prop 19?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I mean, a lot of it depends on the federal response. I mean, if the feds are kind of hands off about this and say, California, do your own thing, and if it's easy for people to, you know, pay taxes and then smuggle it out, I mean, that's a lot of money that could actually come into California. But on the other hand, you know, they really could step up enforcement this idea of drug tourism. Drug tourism could generate a lot of money, but that would be something easy if the federal government wanted to, they could shut it down. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing, when Attorney General Holder, he came out and said that they were going to vigorously enforce federal law. Well, who knows what vigorously enforce means? I mean, right now, they could go, I mean, they don't have the desire nor the resources to go after every single pot smoker in California. I mean, they could do that right now, they don't. But one thing to realize is that if these retail and commercial establishments are paying taxes, I mean, we're going to have their addresses. So, I mean, if the federal government wanted to, they could come and shut them down. You know, so, I mean, there's a lot remains to be seen in terms of what they actually mean by vigorously enforce.
That a lot of this is thrown out like this never happened before. You know, we don't know what's happened. Like I said, all this has happened with medical marijuana. We saw this with the Bush administration. You know, my company's been paying income taxes for, you know, almost 10 years now, and, you know, giving the federal government our address, and then people say, oh, we can't do that because, you know, but there's about 1,500 cannabis outlets in California that are doing that, that are paying income taxes, that have given their... my point is that, you know, to say, you know, a lot of the arguments are that, you know, this can't happen, it'll never happen. It already is. Like I said, we're California's already collecting about $105 million a year in sales tax on the medical marijuana billion-dollar industry.
Federal enforcement?
Well, I think, you know, getting to that, I think both make good points as far as, you know, exactly, it's unpredictable what the federal government's going to do on this. But I think that one point I want to bring up is that, you know, regarding Proposition 215 in the medical marijuana community, there's far from unanimous opinion in the medical marijuana community about Proposition 19. There's, you know, we've seen it. A lot of opposition, you know, there is a lot of support, but I think it's very divided within that community on what exactly the effects are going to be. I mean, I've heard some arguments that, you know, from those within the medical marijuana community that we don't even have Proposition 215 right yet. We're still fighting that in the courts. You know, that's something that I think needs to be considered. And then going to the argument about turnout, yeah, consistently over the last 2 weeks, we've seen most major public polls in California kind of move against Proposition 19 or indicate a move against Proposition 19. At the same time, we've seen Attorney General Jerry Brown increasing his lead in California, Senator Barbara Boxer increasing her lead to some degree in California. I think so the argument that this is some type of a partisan issue, again, we're not. I don't think the numbers bear that out. That it would, that it's going to somehow generate a larger turnout on that on that sense for Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, any particular one group.
Richard, some people thought you should have waited for 2012 when the turnout was going to be somewhat more for a presidential election, and you'd be able to sort of leverage California's more liberal and libertarian leanings. Why did you decide to go forward with this year?
Well, basically, we looked at the poll numbers, and we saw that we had a good shot, and we believe that we've already been victorious. We've already made this legitimate political issue and, you know, got a lot of people thinking about it, and if we don't win this year, it'll make it easier for us to win in 2012.
Hmm. All right. Both sides have talked a bunch about the specter of driving under the influence. Prop 19's supporters have said that nothing changes, basically. Driving under the influence is illegal. It will continue to be illegal. It will still be as prosecutable as before. But I know that Mothers Against Drunk Driving has been an enormous member of your Public Safety First Coalition. Tim, what are your concerns about that?
Well, I think there's a couple concerns. One, the initiative doesn't include any standard of impairment or for impairment. It doesn't even spell it out, doesn't reference it in code at all or reference back to existing code regarding impairment. I think that's problematic as far as what constitutes being under the influence or impaired by marijuana. It will be legal to have marijuana in your system and be behind the wheel of a car. That's clear. Proponents acknowledge that it would even, or at least I've seen in a newspaper editorial that proponents have acknowledged that it would be, under Prop 19, it would be legal for passengers to be smoking marijuana in a car while the car is moving. The driver cannot smoke while driving, but passengers would be able to do that. So I think that kind of sets the basis for the concerns Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I think numerous law enforcement officials on how to enforce that, and with consumption going up, and they have already seen an increase with drug driving and drunk driving and impaired driving due to prescription drugs and other things is already a huge problem. So I think those are some of the reasons that Mothers Against Drunk Driving and others are worried again, and it's. I think that it kind of underscores in the initiative that some of these things aren't particularly spelled out well and some of the weaknesses in this initiative that need to be corrected if another attempt at legalization is made.
Richard, what about those concerns?
First of all, I'd like to say that, you know, we did try to keep the initiative short and simple so the voters could understand it. We did put in a clause to allow the legislature to expand upon it and to fix any deficiencies, you know, that are aimed at, you know, the goals of it, not, you know,
right,
rolling it back, obviously. But, you know, whereas like 215, you know, there's been a court's rulings that talk about how SB 420, parts of SB 420 were thrown out because, mm-hmm. you know, they couldn't, the legislature cannot override a citizen passed initiative. So we specifically allowed the legislature to come in and, you know, improve upon it, fix any defects. The driving issue, you know, we do not, you know, encourage people to drive, or, you know, we wrote it to try to, you know, keep the same laws in place as is for alcohol. One thing I think a lot of people don't understand, though, who don't have any experience with cannabis, don't realize is that, well, you know, we don't say anybody should drive with cannabis, it's not near as dangerous as alcohol. All the driving studies, tests have shown that people are much more aware of their incapacitation with cannabis than they are with alcohol. With alcohol, you don't realize how drunk you are, and, you know, if you drive into a bus or whatever, with cannabis, people tend to slow down or not drive at all because they're very aware.
I would you know, I don't have personal experience with that, but there was one recent columnist by Los Angeles Times, Steve Lopez, who did a test, actually, where it was sponsored by some members of law enforcement down in Los Angeles, did a driving test, and he and another reporter, I think for a radio station, et cetera, did a driving test, and they both had gotten their medical marijuana card, had smoked, and it was a LAPD driving course that they put them under, and both had failed unbelievably. And his opinion, at least what the column articulated, was his opinion about driving under the influence, you know, and marijuana's effects on that really changed. And I think certainly driving under the influence of alcohol, marijuana, and, you know, any of those types of things that will impair you is something that we ought to be concerned about. Getting back to the point of, you know, of Proposition 19 is many of those standards are not even included in the initiative. And so that is a point of serious concern that, you know, again, it's not quite crafted very well.
Well, if I just run real quickly, if you were talking about like a blood alcohol level or the equivalent for cannabis, most police officers use impairment testing, not BAC, to test for, you know, impairment. So the same rules would apply for cannabis.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to start taking your questions very soon. So if you have a question, please start lining up at the mic now. We'll be taking questions, not statements. About 4 minutes or so. Let's go back to the campaign. I know we said that we wanted to stick with the issues here, but you know, I'm a reporter and I can't resist a little bit of horse race here. I think it's interesting the way that both campaigns have tried to mobilize their constituencies. You've been doing, Richard, a lot of sort of virtual organizing. There's your Facebook page had 219,000 people liking it as of this afternoon. Or I should say the proposition's Facebook page, not your personal Facebook page. I'm sure a lot of people like you too.
Has the No Side broke 1,000 yet?
Oh. We have, and most of it are out of state people who are 18, 19, and say yes. So you know.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't think we could possibly say that all 219,000 of these people are likely California voters, obviously. But it has made a sort of a splash. And, you know, you guys are holding a telephone town hall, actually, with thousands of voters right now, even as we speak. How was this conceived, basically? I mean, what was the... who are you trying to reach out to, basically, by doing these somewhat alternative methods of campaigning?
Well, we're trying to reach out to the voters, especially the undecided voters, mm-hmm. to educate them because, you know, it is a complex issue. A lot of people are confused about the difference between medical marijuana and adult cannabis. And so, yeah, we're trying to get the word out and communicate with them.
With a somewhat younger block of voters, I would think, right?
Definitely, but also mothers with young children is a, you know, big demographic that, you know, has concerns about how Prop 19 will do a better job of protecting their kids than Prohibition has.
Okay. Tim?
As far as the campaign?
Yeah.
We've been trying to raise money. I mean, that's...
well, you do have the Chamber of Commerce on your side. That's...
Well, yeah, yeah. Then they're helping out a bit with some of their concerns. But, yeah, it's been real tough. We've been really focusing on an earned media campaign. We think that more people get to know and become educated about the initiative, the more likely they are to oppose it. And so we've been taking great pains to really kind of sit down with editorial boards, sit down with reporters, sit down with columnists, you know, do some of those things to communicate because, you know, we don't have necessarily the resources to be up on television and that type of thing. So we're really... It's an education process, and that's been the focus of our campaign.
Very good.
Could I ask Mr.
Yes,
Rosales
Richard.
One question?
Yeah.
Sure. Right now, a lot of people say that cannabis is already legal in California because there are so many doctors, you know, pretty willing to recommend it for a price, mm-hmm. you know, to anybody with fairly minor, you know, ailments. Do you agree with that? I mean, if that's true, then it seems like all we're doing is you know, codifying and making it easier for the state to deal with it, you know, changing the actual state law so that we can tax and regulate it, what's already out there and already happening. And if it is true that, you know, everybody's able to get medical marijuana already, then, you know, it won't change things.
Well, I think, you know, one thing you have to look at is, again, within the within your medical cannabis community, there's a lot of dispute on Proposition 19, and many are talking about how Proposition 215 isn't working well, and there needs to be adjustments and changes to that that law, and that they're fighting some of those things every day. So I think that, you know, before we start to move on to another major public policy decision, which Proposition 19 would really drastically push California beyond any other jurisdiction, either in the United States or internationally, regarding marijuana, that we kind of get it right what we have already on the books. So that's what I would say to that.
All right. As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum Division, and tonight we're hosting an evening in conversation on marijuana economics, California's Proposition 19, with Tim Rosales, campaign manager for No on Prop 19, Dr. Bo Kilmer, co-director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center, and Richard Lee, co-proponent of Proposition 19 and founder of Oaksterdam University. I'm Josh Richman, politics and legal affairs writer for the Oakland Tribune and Bay Area News Group. Now let's go to the audience for questions. Sir.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the panel how they feel about roughly 2 million Americans being incarcerated, and 50% of those, roughly, are incarcerated because of drug-related problems. And then the cost of that individual being in prison is roughly $50,000 a year. The price, say, of putting a kid through college is just the tuition, maybe around $12,000 or $20,000 a year. And then when that person is incarcerated, presumably it's a male, there is a wife, and that has there's a cost involved there, and there's children involved.
So we're talking about
Yes, sir. Yeah, the tremendous. What I'm basically saying. Let me ask the question, please. How do you feel about this enormous cost that society is bearing? And this is a country based on laws, and don't laws have to make sense? Thank you,
Mr. Rosales. Why don't you start with that?
Well, I would just go back to the data in California, which again, less than 1% of the populations incarcerated due to marijuana offenses, and those are mostly large, you know, possession to distribute. But secondly, we have to look at the costs associated with Proposition 19. Multiple newspaper editorial boards, and I think, you know, with the Attorney General's latest statement, according to Senator Dianne Feinstein's office, $9.4 billion of K-12 education money is tied in with federal drug-free workplace standards. Now, if the federal government decided to really enforce federal drug-free workplace standards, what does that mean for potential grants and funding? Federal drug-free workplace standards require that if you have received federal grants or federal contracts, do business with the federal government, and over $100,000, that you have to meet federal drug-free workplace requirements. Many independent analysis and newspaper editorials have said that that could put California out of compliance, or at least California businesses, educational institutions, out of compliance. So that cost is certainly, the potential for that cost is certainly there, I think, to offset, I think, you know, some of what you're talking about.
Mr. Lee, the societal costs?
Well, to address the point about the drug-free workplace federal, that report that said that was authored by the California Chamber of Commerce, who has actively come out against it. So it's not a, you know, independent report.
They authored it before they came out against it.
Oh, okay. That makes it unbiased. Okay. Well, anyway, take it, you know, for whatever it's worth, you know, based on that.
Yeah.
And then what was your other question?
We were talking about that the gentleman wanted to know about the societal costs that are associated with prohibition right now. And
well, you know, not only is there the economic cost, you know, like you said, it costs more to incarcerate somebody than it does to send them to college for a year. Mm-hmm. But also, to me, the bigger issue is the loss of respect for the laws and law enforcement. That the fact that we have the police out there waging war on our own citizens, you know, and no wonder they're fighting back, or, you know, that they don't feel like the police are there to protect them and help them.
Dr. Kilman?
Sir, I share your concern. So that as a researcher, what I do is I think that the way we get at this and we reduce incarceration, especially for drug offenses, is getting community corrections right. Really doing a better job with probation and parole and getting individuals who need treatment, getting them in there. So I spend my time actually looking for innovative programs, whether they be in Hawaii or here in San Francisco with the Community Justice Center. There are a lot of really innovative things that people are trying as a way to, you know, for those individuals that get in trouble with drugs who need treatment, there are different ways that we can get them into treatment. And that's where I think more attention and more resources need to be going, so that when these individuals, when they first get caught up in the system, we can actually begin helping them before it actually gets to the point where they're spending 3, 4, 5 years in prison. Because Richard's exactly right. This is more than just a cost to what it costs the taxpayers. There are real costs associated with incarceration for these individuals and their families.
I see we have a lot of people waiting at the mic, so our next question, and please remember, brevity is the soul of wit.
Sure. The question is for Richard Lee. I suppose anyone else can comment on it. But there are two points specifically which I've heard mentioned as points opposed to passage of Prop 19, which I don't think are true, one being that parents can lose their children if they're smoking in front of kids, and that this is a new thing. If you could comment whether that's any change to present law, and also if there's any change that Prop 19 would make regarding medical cannabis patients, and maybe you could comment generally on that, specifically on medical cannabis gardens and the size limitations.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lee?
The proposition does have a prohibition on smoking in front of kids, the idea being to deal with the issue of secondhand smoke, you know, whereas with you drink in front of kids, you don't have to worry about that, but if you obviously, secondhand smoke's an issue with smoking. And the second half was?
The second half was?
The second half was does it change the medical cannabis?
Oh, yes. No, it does not change the medical cannabis laws under Prop 215 or SB 420, but it could really help cities and counties be able to tax and regulate medical marijuana dispensaries, outlets under state law, because right now SB 420 is kind of being stretched, you know, in its application in a lot of ways. You know, strictly speaking, SB 420 only allows members of a cooperative to reimburse other members for providing the cost of cannabis, but really the 1,500 dispensaries across the state operate more like retail businesses, and so Prop 19 will make that definitely legal under state law.
All right. Let's move on to the next question, please.
Hey, thank you all for your time. My question has to do with access and distribution. Roughly right now, about 90% of the state is in moratoria and or a ban. You have that percentage that basically won't even recognize medical or compassionate use. I guess this question is more for you, Mr. Lee. How do you feel that those cities and counties right now that are essentially being punted to are going to react to a direct federal conflict with allowing dispensing and access? And will we see a black market exponentially flourish in the other parts of the state that don't allow that? Thank you.
Just one thing I forgot to mention is that the penalty for smoking in front of your kids is not loss of the children, though. The punishment is not that severe. So I just wanted to clear that up. As far as some cities allowing cannabis and not others, first of all, the reason Prop 19 was written the way it was, that it only, you know, allows cities and counties to tax and regulate sales and commercial cultivation, it doesn't mandate, is because of federal law. We could not set up a positive conflict where it forced cities and counties or the state to tax and regulate it. But that's already happening with medical marijuana, as far as some cities opting in, some out. You know, even with the federal government saying they're not going to, you know, to bust people for medical marijuana, not all cities are going ahead with it. So Prop 19 does follow that kind of cultural, historical, you know, precedent that, you know, and again with alcohol prohibition, not all places legalized alcohol right away, not all did it in the same way. So by giving more control to localities is better, And even, you know, we still have dry counties in some states, you know, where they don't sell alcohol, but we don't see, you know, necessarily Al Capone-type violence in those dry localities. You know, as long as we legalize it most places, it will, I think, deal with the problem.
Tim, you know, real quick before we get to the next question, is there a problem with a system of wet and dry counties?
Well, I mean, it's one of the arguments with Prop 19 is we would regulate marijuana like we would alcohol. Well, Prop 19 doesn't regulate marijuana anything like we regulate alcohol in California. Alcohol is regulated at state level. This really, again, punts to, you know, 487 cities and 59 counties. And everybody is kind of left to do it on how they see fit, kind of figure it out yourself approach. And so I just don't necessarily see that. Again, you're going to have the same types of problems that you have right now with that some within the medical marijuana industry are saying that they have with 215. Mm-hmm. I don't see those, you know, resolving themselves with Prop 19.
Richard, real quick.
Yes. We do have all the different cities and counties already have different alcohol laws. They have different zoning laws on where they allow alcohol to be sold, how it's sold. So this isn't new. That's already been done. And I guess that's the main comment on it.
Sir.
So, I have two questions. The first one
Pick your favorite.
all right, I'll go with the one I wasn't going to ask, but substitution of alcohol versus marijuana. One of your points was that there was some debate about the substitution between that people may go more to marijuana instead of alcohol. And my understanding is that we will not be changing the smoking laws. So you cannot go to a bar, smoke, instead of drink. And so I just wanted to see if you could discuss maybe a little bit about what that change would actually mean. My assumption is people would not do that switch. And then what does that actually mean in terms of, I think just as a general socializing thing, people are not going to bars, hanging out in large groups anymore. It just creates a very different social environment and then also changes the tax income for alcohol in a place like San Francisco where many young people mm-hmm. do go out to bars to congregate.
I think he does bring up a good point about the difference between bars, restaurants, and liquor stores, you know, to go on-site and then on-site with food. And then there's different tax rates. Alcohol at a bar is taxed a lot higher than at a liquor store where you buy the whole bottle and take it home, so that might affect the tax, you know, revenue. You know, I don't think y'all have figured that into your computations at all, that, you know, you could have different tax rates for different, you know, ways it's sold.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're very clear about that. We don't know what the tax revenue is going to be. But with respect to the literature, a lot of the literature on this was looking at what Richard mentioned before about, you know, how some states have decriminalized. And so what they were doing is they were looking at, well, in states where it's been decriminalized, where it's assumed that use is higher, how has that influenced alcohol? And to the extent that what happens on the streets isn't necessarily what happens, you know, doesn't necessarily match what's on the books, that literature is all over the place. So for a while there, that's how we were learning about whether or not alcohol and marijuana were substitutes. We're looking at this decriminalization literature, and you can pick different studies. They all said different things. But in more recent years, we've actually been able to get information about what happens when the price changes for marijuana. How does that influence alcohol use? And within the United States, I only know of two studies. One study in it, you know, had conflicting findings in it. And then there was another study that actually came out and showed that there was a statistically significant relationship suggesting that they were complements, that they were used together. However, if you got down and really interpreted what those coefficients are, it was a well-estimated zero, meaning we really don't have a good idea. But stepping back for a moment, remember what I said about when you're talking about economics, you know, most of the literature is all focused on marginal changes. If I change the price for a joint by a couple dollars, how does that influence alcohol consumption? It's all based on the margins. The price decreases you're going to see after legalization in California are going to be really large. And so we can't necessarily even say that the literature that we have on this would even be applicable post-legalization because it's going to be such a large change. And as I said before, we don't know what the demand curve is.
You want to throw down on this, Tim?
Well, just one interesting, it's kind of just a side point, one interesting thing about California law and smoking in non-public places, it relates to tobacco smoke. It doesn't relate to any other kind of smoke. We have hookah bars and we have all kinds of different things. So that is an oversight. So if you look at California law and California code, it just specifically relates to tobacco, which is interesting.
All right. Our next question.
Hi, my question is for Tim. I feel like tonight a lot of your arguments against Prop 19 were centered around the fact that they're not public policy solutions for either this or that. Mm-hmm. And also in response to the whole DUI concept, I just feel like as any driver, male, female, someone who is legally allowed to drive, it's a responsibility issue to the driver, not
your
about
question.
The substance. So my question comes down to, what is your major argument, aside from the actual clarity of the document of Prop 19, what's your major argument against legalization of marijuana in California?
I'm not arguing legalization of marijuana in California. I think that there is a debate to be had, a legitimate debate to be had about that.
Correct.
My argument is in Proposition 19 itself, and that I think what has been clearly opined by a number of, over 40 major newspapers in California, is that there are some real significant public policy problems in California, or in Proposition 19, where even newspapers like the Oakland Tribune, like editorial board, the San Francisco Chronicle, Mercury News, et cetera, have all said, even if you support marijuana legalization, Proposition 19 isn't the way to do it. Again, I think that it presents, from the lack of any kind of real taxing structure to public safety problems, to we haven't even really touched in kind of workplace safety problems and just even employers' rights kind of issues related to Proposition 215 and how it could overturn potentially Ross versus Raging Wire. We haven't touched on some of those issues, but I think that there are real significant public policy issues within Prop 19. Certainly. An argument is to be had about it.
Okay. I definitely want to get to our last couple. We're running low on time, sir.
Okay. Thank you. This is for Richard. The initiative does allow expressly the legislature to come in and make amendments and changes in keeping with the purposes of Proposition 19. Our local assemblyman here, Tom Amiano, has a bill, AB X6-9, which is a new iteration of AB 390, which calls for basically sales of marijuana if Prop 19 passes in every single off-sale premises general licensee, which means every liquor store, every grocery store that has liquor sales, all 13,000 of them. First of all, is the Prop 19 campaign or you personally in favor of that broad of a distribution system in the state of California? And even if you are, is such a thing constitutionally permissible when the purposes of Prop 19 say that it will ensure that a city, if it chooses not to tax and regulate, that sales shall remain illegal in that jurisdiction? Can there be such a broad distribution system set up by the state?
It's a good question. I guess you have to ask a lawyer about that. you do have a good point that, we did try to leave it for the legislature to expand upon, to address, he did bring up the issue of the different, localities having different laws, and that hopefully the legislature would be able to come back and not have to worry about the courts throwing out, or the federal government coming after, a legislation that's passed.
We have about 1 minute and one questioner left.
Great. So just having had some personal experience in consumption of marijuana and knowing that belligerence and aggressiveness from alcohol is greatly higher than cannabis use, what studies have been done to compare cannabis use to alcohol abuse, and what is the social responsibility impact and cost to include cannabis abuse in our current drug abuse programs?
Actually, a great book just came out. I think it was either Oxford University Press or Cambridge University Press, 2010. It was called Cannabis Policy. And it's done by Robert Room and kind of a team of international scholars. And actually, in that book, I think it's chapter 2, it actually compares alcohol, tobacco, nicotine, heroin, cocaine, on a variety of different measures. And definitely, it suggests that by itself, cannabis is safer than alcohol. But, you should look at these different scales themselves. But that has been done. It's a really good book.
Check out the book. It is the newly founded Inform tradition of 2010 that we are asking of all of our speakers the following question. Sir, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? Mr. Lee.
Just say, in cannabis prohibition.
Okay.
Keep it on the side.
Raise alcohol taxes.
Raise alcohol taxes. Okay. And Tim?
Vacation.
All right, let's give a big round of applause to Mr. Lee, Mr. Rosales, and Dr. Kilmer for sharing their insights with us tonight. Now, this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.